might be available for hunting or gathering. Our agricultural revolution made even more important planting crops at the wrong time could lead to starvation and death. Now, people use the cycle of the moon as well as the daily apparent rise and fall of the sun from the sky as the ways of tracking time. You can blame those early Mesopotamians, by the way, the Sumerians in the 3rd millennium B.C. and the later Babylonians who lived there for that base 60 and base 12 units of measurement. You know, the common concept of a dozen, 12 by 2 hours, 12 by 5 minutes and seconds in each hour and minute respectively, and of course 12 times 30 degrees in full circles. There's no definitive reason for this choice, but there are many theories, and one of them that I particularly like is that early man might have often counted up...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Early man, theoretically, and there's some stories of some strange cultures that still sort of do that, that they count each little third segment of their finger, those are phalanges, with their thumb, and so it's there's three phalanges for the four remaining fingers, so that's 12. So that's one possible reason why the Mesopotamians decided to do a 12-based time and degree of angle type of thing. Anyway, at first the time of day was a local affair. Different towns would often have different times, roughly similar but not quite the same. It wasn't until the development of trains that there was present need for a standardized time, agreed upon by all with proper time zones. By the dawn of the 20th century, though, each second was well defined by being 1/86,400th of a solar day. Now, that's not a sidereal day, which is actually how long it takes our Earth to make a complete revolution, but a solar day. The problem is that our Earth wobbles a bit, and that standard isn't accurate enough. Let me drop for a second. Okay, in 1945, Isidore Rabi proposed using an atomic beam magnet resonance as a basis for a much more accurate clock. The first atomic clock was based on an ammonia absorption line. It had a resonance frequency of 23,870.1 megahertz. It was built in 1949 by the U.S. National Bureau of Standards, but unfortunately, it was less accurate than the present quartz watch that you might be wearing this very moment. But, you know, it was a successful proof of concept, if you will. Now, the first accurate atomic clock, the cesium standard, based on a certain transition of cesium-133 atoms, was built by Louis Essen and Jack Perry in 1955 at the National Physical Laboratory in the United Kingdom. The International System of Units has defined the second as the duration of 9,162,631,770 cycles of radiation corresponding to the transition between two energy levels of the ground state of the cesium-133 atom. Let me drop for a second. In 1997, the International Committee for Weights and Measures added that the preceding definition refers to cesium atom at rest at a temperature of absolute zero. So that's rather strange, but that's what they did. Atomic clocks have been based upon the hyperfine transition of cesium-133, rubidium-87, and helium-1. The Galileo satellite system, by the way, is using hydrogen-1 hyperfine transition to calibrate its clocks. GPS satellites often have multiple rubidium and cesium-based atomic clocks to maintain their accuracy. But what, you ask me, is a hyperfine structure transition? Well, you probably didn't, but I'll tell you anyway. We've talked before that all charged particles moving at a fixed velocity, either linearly or angularly, produce a magnetic field around themselves. So electrons do this, and an unpaired electron, a valence electron, the outermost energy level of hydrogen, or cesium, or rubidium, possess this as well. It's the strangeness of quantum mechanics in that we call it spin angular momentum, and it can only have two values, +1/2 and -1/2, no more, no less. For an electron in free space, whether the electron has a quantum spin of +1/2 or -1/2, it's all rather irrelevant. But we're talking about an atom here with a nucleus, and deep inside that nucleus is another unpaired particle, a proton. with its own quantum spin angular momentum, and its unpaired electrons are... Whether cesium's unpaired proton and its unpaired electron are spinning in the same direction or the opposite direction causes a different energy state, and the result of this very tiny little difference is called the hyperfine structure. Let me drop it. Now, rubidium atomic clocks are less accurate than cesium clocks, but they also are less expensive to manufacture. You can pick up a used rubidium atomic clock on eBay for as little as $100 used. Although they don't age well, their accuracy tends to decline. Now, they've improved the accuracy for this method, for these methods by improvements in laser cooling and trapping technology advances, and even the use of the Fabry-Perot cavity that we talked about that's used for the LIGO gravitational wave detector. A fully functional cesium-based atomic clock has been commercially manufactured to be smaller than 2 cubic inches in volume. Basically, it ionizes a sample of cesium and radiates a infrared laser with a microwave frequency modulating signal. When the modulating signal reaches the resonant frequency of cesium-133's hyperfine structure, the infrared laser transmission amplitude through the ionized cesium peaks and a feedback loop offers an accurate clocking mechanism. Let me drop for a second. The National Institute of Standards and Technology uses a variation of a cesium atomic clock, which they call a cesium fountain atomic clock. Their designation, I think, is NIST-F1. It is accurate to 3.1 times 10 to the minus 16. They're working on something based on the same principle, but tuned up a little bit. It's going to be called NIST-F2. It's going to have even better resolution. But let me drop for a second and I'll carry on. There's a new technology that offers even higher accuracy. The previous ones have a resonance in the microwave range. Newer designs that people are working on, called optical clocks, hold as little as a single ion in suspension or a small lattice of ions. They supercool them with lasers. We talked about how lasers can supercool things. These clocks are based upon the transitions that occur in the optical rather than the microwave electromagnetic spectrum. Now, many ions have been used to implement this type of device: mercury, strontium, or tibium. There's a whole bunch of them. The theoretical accuracy for the design of this type of device is error of one part in 10 to the minus 19. It means that it loses less than a second for the entire lifetime of the universe. But even the stranger thing about it is you have to correct it for your altitude, because if you take this very accurate device and move it up or down by a centimeter, the Einstein's law of general relativity will report a different time frame. So you have to, in addition for it to be at 0 degrees like the cesium, you now have to define its gravitational attraction as part of its definition of a second. That should be fun if that had happened. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
AC2GS, AC2PL.
CPL.
Can you discuss the GPS discipline oscillators that are kind of inexpensively available, and I guess people use them to calibrate equipment based on the GPS signals?
Yes, I can. In addition to rubidium, which you can buy on eBay for not much, you can also purchase a ground position satellite, a discipline oscillator. It has usually it's a crystal, oven crystal quartz, and a GPS it's a receiver. It receives the overhead satellite signals by way of a GPS antenna and calculates the time standard based upon the GPS satellite's rubidium and cesium clock. They usually have more than a few, and they figure out if one of them is veering off from the rest, they shut it down or they recalibrate it. So it's based on GPS time signals, which are based on cesium and rubidium time calibrations, and it disciplines the quartz crystal. They are less expensive than even used rubidium, and they require a great deal less power. Rubidium time standards can be somewhat small, but not as small as GPS, and requires a significant amount more energy because it has to generate a small rubidium plasma as part of the mechanism for the way it works. So you can easily use a couple of watts, maybe 10 or 15 or 20 watts, running a rubidium time stamp, whereas you can run a GPS discipline, a quartz oscillator with a lot less power, a lot less heat. So that's the short one. Any other questions about that?
Comment.
Yes, Hank.
ECTGFPC2SHO. We found out something here that kind of surprised me. I wasn't that that read up on all of the reference standards that are out there for frequency reference standards. But we found something interesting here that kind of surprised me, and that's that we had a GPS frequency reference that was installed, and although the specs had a very good long-term stability, we found that it had some short-term instability that was causing us some consternation. So it may be that you can get a pretty good frequency reference, using the GPS discipline method, but I think the cost will still be quite high because you still need some pretty high high stability, local oscillation or local oscillator internally, even if you have the GPS reference. So just something that might be interesting, and I'm sure you have more knowledge on it than I do, but I guess the gist of it is don't depend on just because it's GPS locked, to the satellite's time, it doesn't mean that you're going to get a short-term stability out of the local oscillator. EC2, GS, KC2, SHO.
Thank you, John. I agree with you. And matter of fact, that's pretty much as far as I know. That's why these GPSs are not just straight GPSs. I mean, theoretically, I guess, you could just have it decode the time code and implement it directly. But usually what happens is you implement something called the GPS discipline quartz oscillator. So what you basically have is a quartz oven oscillator that is steady over the short term, but due to aging and such can slowly shift out of spec. And that's disciplined by the GPS signal that might be a little bit more erratic in the short term, but over the long term it evens out. So you have the strength of both type of time standards augmenting the other. And matter of fact, on my Flex 6700, I have a GPS discipline frequency calibrator, and it's a lovely thing to behold. I mean, I don't have to check the clock or the time or anything. It's right there on the screen.
A VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I remember there was a GPS disciplined oscillator circuit in a back issue of QEX magazine, what they disciplined against was the 1 hertz, one cycle per second tick for the seconds counter of the clock. They did not lock on to the or discipline against the microwave signal. They actually disciplined their crystal oscillator to the one cycle per second tick of the clock. So go ahead. Okay, but I mean, ultimately, the cause of that time stamp on the GPS is based upon the rubidium and cesium clock standards, right? Yeah, but that would cause, that would account for the short-term, lack of precision or accuracy, whereas it would give you a long-term high precision. Yes, I would agree, but I think that's the underlying method used in most GPS disciplined oscillators. I don't know of any company selling devices that just purely decode GPS signals with high accuracy. Well, this was in QEX magazine, so commercial units might do it differently. Okay. That's possible, and it also could be an economic problem that to do it with finesse might add significantly into the cost factor. It's just less expensive, and ultimately, when you look at the final results of doing it this way, it gives you a relatively similar accuracy. So, yeah.
Hey, CPL query?
Yes, CPL.
So the accuracy that's quoted with the kind of the ham grade GPS DO units that are available is 0.1 or maybe 0.01 or 0.05 hertz in the short term. Is that what you understand it to be as well?
So that's the general specs that most of these devices tend to have.
Okay, Roger. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments on this particular topic before we move on to the next? Okay, we've kind of been through this before, but there's some more information, so I thought people who are following Japan's Hayabusa 2 probe touchdown would be interested in this. A new image was released by JAXA showing a distinctive smudge on the asteroid where the procedure took place, but the cause of the dark surface feature isn't immediately clear to anyone. Japan's mission to extract surface samples from an asteroid and return them to Earth appears to be going exceptionally well. The collection phase of the mission happened last week when the Hayabusa 2 probe made its much-anticipated descent onto the surface of the 1-kilometer-wide asteroid, which is located 2 billion miles away from Earth. To gather samples, the Hayabusa 2 probe used a projector, a kind of gun, and shot a 5-gram tantalum bullet into the surface of Ryugu at approximately 1,000 feet per second. Debris kicked up by the impact was then collected by the probe sampler horn, and at least that's the theory. We won't really know what happened until the material returns in December of 2020. A new image released by JAXA, which I put up on my link page, roy.ac2gs.com, shows a black smudge at the sample site. Hayabusa 2 took the photo with its optical navigation camera about 1 minute after the touchdown and as it was returning to its home position some 12.4 miles above the asteroid. The probe snapped the photo when it was about 82 feet sample site. The cause of that, the nature of the darkened areas, aren't really entirely clear yet. Let me drop for a second. Okay, so the color of the region beneath the spacecraft shadow differed from the surroundings and has been discolored by the touchdown, noted the JAXA press release. At the moment, the reason for the deceleration is unknown, but maybe due to the grit that was blown upward by the spacecraft thrusters or the bullet itself. Both theories make sense, and it could be a combination of the two. It's not clear yet if the impact itself caused the deceleration, or if activities by the probe upturned darkened material from below, or if it's something else entirely different. An annotated image shows the planned touchdown site in purple. There's an article that you can see that. The JAXA mission planners are hoping to land 13 to 16. We're planning to land 13 to 16 feet from the marker. The BBC reported looking at the 6-meter-wide target area in the dark splotches, it would appear that the Hayabusa 2 nailed that particular landing site rather well. JAXA also released an image showing the area prior to touchdown. In that image, no discoloration can be seen, which probably means that the probe's activities are almost certainly responsible for the new surface feature. In preparatory tests done on Earth by JAXA, the tremendous force of the bullet's impact could be seen in a slow-motion footage, and it should give and thus surprises no one of the kind of impact that it gave Ryugu with its minimal gravity and produced that dramatic surface feature. So I will post the article on my website, and you can read it and look at the pictures and such. It's, another chapter in Hayabusa 2's intriguing travels. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I haven't found that picture yet on your site. Maybe it's not up yet. But I'm looking for it now. Did you see the Hayabusa picture with looking at the surface and they showed the shadow of the spacecraft on the surface? I thought that was pretty neat. Very neat. Did you see that one?
Paul, that was the one that I meant to post before this talk. I'll do it after the talk. But yeah, that's the image that really caught my eye. You see this kind of shadow in the distance, which looks to be the Hayabusa 2 spacecraft leaving with a shadow, and then you see those smudge marks of where they scuffed up the surface of Ryugu.
Yeah, I haven't seen the scuff marks yet. I did see the shadow, though.
Okay, well, probably, right after 11 o'clock when I'm done with my spiel, I will post all these things to roy.ac2.com. Okay, on to the next. And, I find this interesting. I hope someone out there does as well. There are strange things going on down on a pair of Australian siblings are some of the rarest human beings ever documented, according to their doctors. They say that the brother and sister are semi-identical twins, sharing the exact same DNA from their mother's side, but only a portion of their father's genetic makeup. The children are thought to be only the second case of semi-identical twins discovered and the first to be identified during pregnancy. The story of the twins was detailed in a case report published last Wednesday in the New England Journal of Medicine. According to the authors, the siblings are a class of twins called sesquizygotic. Sesquizygotic. Of a midpoint between fraternal and identical twins. Let's stop for a second. Fraternal twins happens when two different sperm cells fertilize two different egg cells, creating two different zygotes, both of which end up implanted in the uterus as developing embryos. So they're as genetically similar, approximately 50%, as any two average siblings would be. They're just born at the same time. Now, identical twins, on the other hand, are made when the same sperm fertilizes the same egg, but then the zygote splits into two embryos, each sharing the same exact genetic mix of DNA from their mother and their father. Now, in this case, the authors theorize the two sperm cells simultaneously fertilize the same egg. Now, ordinarily, that sort of mistake quickly results in a miscarriage, since humans usually can't develop with three different sets of chromosomes. Somehow, though, the resulting zygote incorporated an equal split of DNA from all three sets, with three groups of cells forming afterwards. Cells containing the mother's DNA and DNA from sperm 1, cells from the mother's DNA and DNA from sperm 2, and cells containing DNA from only sperm 1 and sperm 2. Over time, the third group of sperm-only cells were effectively crowded out by the cells containing the DNA of both parents. Then, even more unexpectedly, the bundle of cells divided into two separate embryos, creating the twins. Let me drop for a second. So, they are 100% identical on their mother's side, and they're 78% identical on their father's side. So the average comes out to be about 89% identical. Now, while it's apparent within weeks of the pregnancy that the mother was having twins, it wasn't until early in the second trimester that the team noticed that there was something odd going on. The mother's ultrasound at 6 weeks showed a single placenta, and the positioning of the amniotic sacs that indicated she was expecting identical twins. However, on ultrasound at 14 weeks, it showed that the twins were male and female, which shouldn't be possible with identical twins. They are 100% identical now. The doctors involved looked through the medical literature and twin genetic databases for other cases of semi-identical twins, but they only managed to find one other instance. That case was published in 2007 by doctors in the United States and highlights the complexity of biological sex. Let me drop for a second. The U.S. doctors reported that splitting of the paternal chromosomes resulted in one twin being intersex, meaning they had ambiguous genitalia. The other was anatomically male. The Y chromosome is usually what determines a person's sex, with biological males predominantly having XY chromosomes in their cells. But twins, as it turns out, the twins in question in the U.S. had a mix of XY and XX sex chromosomes. But the X twin only had 5% of the XY compared to the XX, while the anatomic male twin had a 50-50 split of both types of genes. The anatomical male twin's share of XX genes simply wasn't enough to stop them from developing male sex organs. The Australian twins, on the other hand, are considered chimeras on their father's side, with one twin roughly having a 50-50 split of XY and XX sex chromosomes, and the other one having a 90-10 split of XX and XY chromosomes. Now, unlike the 2007 case, the twins are anatomically male and female, respectively, but sadly, the female twin had an unrelated blood clot soon after birth that necessitated an amputation of a right configuration. Let me drop for a second. The disorder causes a person's genitalia to not develop normally and to have a very high chance of becoming cancerous, so the twins received a precautionary surgery to remove Still, both twins are now about 4 years old. Otherwise, they appear to be developing normally and doing well. Doctors intend to continue closely monitoring these twins for any further complications. So, their genetics is very screwy, but very unusual and sort of fascinating, at least to me. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2DN. Okay, I guess no one wants to talk about chimeras. We'll move on to the next. Ah, yes. Those rascally Russians. You might remember a previous bit of news I gave you that the Kalashnikov, the famous company famous for their AK-47 assault rifles, were trying their hand as a competitor in the electronic car business against Tesla and others with a very Edsel-like model called the CV-1. Well, it seems that that hasn't gone so well. So they seem to be investigating ways to get back to their roots. You know, their base success is tools of destruction. Kalashnikov is moving into new territory with a drone that can carry up to 3 kilograms of explosives and detonate on impact. The KUB-UAV can travel up to 78 miles per hour and stay in the air for 30 minutes. As there were any doubts as to Kalashnikov's intention for this device, a lovely YouTube video shows the drone attacking some remote targets. The company wants the KUB-UAV to be inexpensive and easy to operate. Isn't that nice? Kalashnikov demonstrated the device at a defense exhibition at Abu Dhabi this week, and according to the Washington Post, representatives said it will be faster, more accurate, and deliver double the explosive power of makeshift devices built by terrorists, who have strapped explosives to publicly available drones in some operations. Let me drop for a second. It's not clear how much the KUB-UAV will cost, but it's ready for use and likely to be very cheap, according to one Kalashnikov representative. The company wants to get the drone in the hands of smaller armies, which is giving some experts cause for some concern. I think of it as democratizing smart bombs, said Nicholas Grossman, a University of Illinois professor of international relations and author of a book called Drones and Terrorism, as told to the Washington Post. It means disseminating smart bombs more widely. This would shrink the gap between the most advanced military and the smaller ones. The potential for drones to carry out attacks has been evident in a number of cases. Back in August, the Venezuela president, Nicolas Maduro, was reportedly the target of an assassination attempt by a drone. A number of airports, as we talked about before, have been forced to ground flights recently because of drones in the area. Some airports are trying to counter such possible threats by investing in anti-drone systems. So, what's next? A feared drone gap. Well, who knows? Brave new world. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments on this. This is 2GX.
Wonderful news, Roy.
What? You got partially cut off.
WB2GXM, you're giving us very cheerful news tonight, Roy.
Well, you know, what can I tell you? If you don't laugh about this stuff, you just cry about it. So, what can I tell you? You got to take this with a grain of salt. The world is a strange, strange thing. And, you know, as I've kind of probably too often mentioned, human beings are capable of great things and of terrible things. And usually we do both of them at the same time.
WB2GXM, I say that we take those drones and take the explosive out and put the flowers in and make them 100 flower delivering drones.
I'm sure if you give Kalashnikov the business, they'll turn it into that. But they tried. I don't know if you ever saw that terrible, terrible car that they positioned as a Tesla replacement. It was awful. But I think they realize that their expertise is in weapons of destruction, and they're just going with it. Okay, on to my next little thing. If you like that, if that made you happy-go-lucky and optimistic, wait till you hear this one. Do you guys remember that brilliant idea to break out all of the military branches of the space program and reorganize them into something that might be designed to defend the Earth from, I don't know, aliens? Russians? Chinese? I don't know who. Well, you know the name, the Space Force. Just the name alone makes me think of fluorescent plastic ray guns from my childhood. I wonder if the crew was going to be recognized similar plastic ray guns. Well, earlier last week, President Donald Trump signed a directive to create the Space Force. what will become the sixth branch of the U.S. military, but the new branch will be placed under the purview of the U.S. Air Force rather than being a separate and autonomous branch, as the president had initially hoped. Back in June 18, Trump announced his intention to create the Space Force, saying it would become the sixth branch of the U.S. military by 2020, and that it would be separate but equal. The Space Force, the first branch of the military in more than seven decades, would allow the U.S. to keep pace with China and Russia, he said, both of which are possibly developing space-based weaponry. In August, Vice President Mike Pence told the Pentagon audience that space had become a war-fighting domain like land, air, and sea, requiring a branch dedicated to protecting U.S. interests and assets in space. Let me drop for a second. The directive signed last week orders the creation of the Space Force, but it'll be a slimmer, less autonomous version than the one initially described, at least at first. The president has directed the Secretary of Defense to draft a legislative proposal that, if enacted, would establish the U.S. Space Force as the sixth branch of the armed forces within the Department of the Air Force. This is a step towards a future separate military department for space, said a senior White House administrative official reportedly recently in an article. The new version of the Space Force should be more palatable to members of Congress, some of whom have expressed concern that the new branch would introduce unnecessary bureaucratic bloat and massive costs. The Air Force should also find it more appetizing as it gets to monitor the new division while retaining its reach into space. In September, a leaked Air Force document claimed that proposed Space Force would cost over $13 billion over the next 5 years, as opposed to the $8 billion cited by the Trump administration. Let me drop for a second. In addition to falling under the purview of the Air Force, the pared-down Space Force will require the Pentagon to consolidate its existing functions to minimize duplication of efforts and eliminate bureaucratic inefficiency. The White House official explained, anyone currently working on space defense, whether military or civilian, will be moved to the Space Force. The branch will get its own four-star general, who will serve on the Joint Chief of Staff, and an Air Force Undersecretary for Space, a civilian position which will be confirmed by the Senate. It'll take years to create a Space Force, as well as several phases of implementation, the official said. The price tag for the new Space Force headquarters should be less than $100 million, colleagues. But costs are not yet set in stone. The White House official said money for the Space Force will be included in the administration's proposed budget for 2020, adding that there's still enough time to get the proposed order into the current year's defense policy bill. Of course, Trump's idea still needs to go through hearings, which have yet to be scheduled. The White House official was optimistic that the proposal will be sent to Congress before budget submissions are due in mid-March. Let me drop for a second. As an aside, if you believe that that's up, I have some choice metropolitan bridge property that I can sell you for a song. Anyone want to buy the Brooklyn Bridge? But I digress. Importantly, Trump's updated directive doesn't mean the administration has lost sight of its original goal of creating a separate but equal branch of the U.S. Armed Forces dedicated to space. Quote, we haven't abandoned the goal, and in fact, we're achieving it. I think with this directive, the president's number one objective, which is a separate armed service, is a possibility, the White House official said. Quote, we've heard the concerns from Congress about not creating a large bureaucratic organization, and I think our thought was if we start going directly to a military department, which I think is our desired end state, then we would spend a lot of time dealing with bureaucracy and structure and not focusing on war fighting. End quote. They all talk like that now. From here, the proposal goes to Congress. Given these changes, the House could very well pass the order, as some members have supported the idea in the past. We'll just have to see how this all turns out. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GM.
WS2N.
GPS for?
I don't see the point of doing what he's trying to do with the Space Force. You have, right now, over 2 times the amount of money going to any military space ventures compared to what goes into NASA. So NASA's roughly $20 billion. You got over $40 billion into the space military portion of it now. I don't understand what they're going to do. Just separate the two. It doesn't make any sense to me. In fact, it sounds like it's going to be even more expensive now. You're going to need another hierarchy to control this. It sounds like a nightmare. Back to you, Brian.
Yes, indeed. I think it all comes down to he likes the name Space Force, and someone showed him a cute insignia that he could sell T-shirts with. And I don't know. My guess, this is going to go the same place that the military parade down Washington went, into the void. They're still writing, they're still signing things, they're still writing requests, demands, executive orders, and what have you. So I thought everyone should know, be up to date with that type of nonsense. So I wouldn't hold my breath waiting for the Space Force to be a thing.
Yeah, every year we launch plenty of rockets into space that I don't even cover on the net. It's just too many of them. They're being launched for the National Reconnaissance Office. There's always quite a few of them per year. Delta rockets are launching them, and you have the X-37B, which is still flying around up there. It flies for years at a time. It looks like a small space shuttle, and it comes down and lands in a runway, and it's basically a spy satellite, and this thing costs a fortune. They have two of them. They go up, one will go up, and the other one will come back, and then the other one goes up. And I think they've done that about 5 different times since 2010. We have basically a Space Force now, so I'm not sure what they're going to try to do. Like you said, maybe just what he wants to see a new logo. I don't get it. Back to you, Roy. WS2S.
We're talking about the same guy who suggested to pretty much shut down all the other programs in NASA so that all the money could be spent getting a man on Mars by 2020. So this is what you're dealing with.
Yeah, well, I think it's all going to change in a couple of years real quick. they got to get back to the way it was. Although, it does have with the different administrations, if you switch administration, they'll switch. At one time we were going to the moon with the Constellation program, and then they killed that, and then they said, okay, we're going to go up to Mars, for 8 years. Now they haven't killed that, but they say, well, let's go back to the moon first with the deep space gateway that they're going to have, another space station going around the moon. So, they keep switching back and forth, I like to see a group go in and just say, let's do both, and then we don't have to worry about it. It's the moon and Mars at the same time.
I think there's the money for that, unfortunately. One of the major flaws in our way of governing is we don't have a consistent long-term plan. Things get brought up, preliminary studies get ordered, and then the guys in charge of them are no longer in charge of them, and it disappears over time. It's a shame that there's no kind of a central organization of people, either elected or appointed, that could conceive of and carry out long-term mission goals without the interruption of different congressional sessions, presidential terms, and what. I don't see any way of doing that. So it's just going to be this hopscotch.
Yeah, I
definitely agree.
Well, that's why we need these private companies involved. You know, although it's not really good enough. You know, you take a company like Blue Origin, that's Jeff Bezos, the richest guy in the world. He's putting about $1 billion a year toward his project, his space-related projects. But it's not enough. I mean, look at NASA. NASA does $20 billion a year. So you would need 20 Jeff Bezos to keep up with NASA.
I think ultimately it's just a matter of going one rung up the supply chain, because, you know, there were major manufacturers for rocket engines and all the things. NASA didn't make most of the stuff themselves. They contracted out. So this is one step from that. The problem is that the underlying engine that fuels it all still, for the most part, is government. It's not commercial. Commercial, for the most part, are interested in satellites. Satellites, I don't think they care. You know, there's not going to be any miracle cures this year, next year, or the following year that can be done in low-gravity environments that will maintain that type of cost-benefit ratio. So I think we're still in trouble until some very smart person figures out a really cheap and effective propulsion system that none of us have a clue about. I still think that we're kind of anchored to the earth at this point.
Yeah, well, that's a long way off. You know, you can't change the laws of physics. You know, yeah, NASA did always pay companies to build these things, but they were always under the direction and blueprints of NASA. So, you know, they hand a contract out to Rockwell to, you know, to build the Apollo spacecraft. They oversaw everything. Now it's different with the commercial ones. They're still paying money out, but they're saying to the commercial companies, here, design it, you handle everything. You know, get the spacecraft up, bring it back, you know, you know, support, you know, even the landing, you know, make, you know, have your own boats. And then come to us and show us what you got, and then we'll approve it, and then we'll pay for it. So that's the difference now with the commercial aspect.
I mean, ultimately, I think what's going on is you have entrepreneurs taking more risks than in the past. All the other stuff in NASA's supply chain were basically military-industrial companies that didn't take too many chances. That they, you know, they wanted a lot of the money up front, on the side, in the middle, and all over the place. So you didn't have quite the entrepreneurial risk-taking that these new billionaires are applying. And I hope they benefit, because if they benefit, we benefit. But who knows what the future has in store for us.
Well, right now you do have a lot of rich people involved with the space program, but take all our money now and start another space force. I don't even think it's going to happen. I really don't. I would bet that it's never going to happen. But I might be wrong. They really are pushing for it. I'll let you continue, Roy. WS2N.
I'm going to wrap up soon anyway, but it's just the administration is really pushing for it, and the people around the administration kind of look there and say, gee, I guess I got to go there. And I really don't see a great deal of enthusiasm outside of the White House, so my guess is it's going to hang up in the Congress and kind of have a dirt nap and fade away. Now, it's all in the realm of possibility that someday, some later day, there will be something in the nature of a space force for when it probably is somewhat more appropriate, if and when the Chinese death satellite pointed at us from the sky or something. But at this point, I think this will go the same way as the military parade. Anyway,
This has been Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Roy with the Science Talk. And once again, as always, I would like to thank all the participants of my little puzzle, and Dick and Paul, and everyone out there listening. So keep in mind, once again, if you have any questions or topics that you would like to have covered, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the links will be available in 5-10 minutes on roy.ac2gs.com. So thanks, everyone. And
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
One quick comment, Roy. When you look at the neutrino picture that you started off with, on the right side and the left side, there's a little bit of excess red dot, which looks vaguely like a ring of material around that star, so to speak, as if there was, you're looking at the Saturn's rings edgewise. You have to use your imagination, but there was a little bit of that effect. I wonder if you saw that. Over to you, Roy.
As you go to lower resolutions of detection, there is a kind of oplate distortion in the image. Now, I can't tell you definitively if that's a real thing or whether it's an aberration of the detection method. The central area where it had a much higher signal is pretty spherical. It's only when it fades out to the periphery. So I don't know what to make of it, and I don't think anyone has really made that there's neutrino generation occurring on the corona. Most people, physicists, tend to believe it's fundamentally a thing that's going on in the sun's core.
And once again, I think because neutrinos will hit a detector so infrequently, to get that many dots in that picture, that represents a significant number of hours of data gathering, is my guess. Okay, thank you, Roy. Good stuff. Paul, WS2N, we've now got some awful good news with reference to, let's see, what's it called? All of a sudden I can't think of the name of the darn thing. You know what I mean. The new launch of, gee, I wrote it down, and I can't find where I wrote it all down.
The Dragon.
You've got it, Paul. Please proceed. K2RIW listening.
Okay, and before I forget it, if anybody wants to contact me, my email is spacenetreport@gmail.com. I always forget to do that. And anything that I come up with and I post, for instance, this week, there'll be a picture of what Dick was talking about, an American inside of a brand new spacecraft that was sent up to the International Space Station. And that picture would be on roy.ac2gs.com. So a little story behind what's going on here. So, yesterday morning, Saturday morning, at like 3 o'clock in the morning, it was roughly 10 to 3, the Falcon 9 launched from Launch Complex 39A, and on top of it, instead of a satellite or a Dragon with cargo on it, they had a Dragon crew vehicle. Drop it. This Dragon crew vehicle has been under development for many years. NASA's been helping pay for it. There's two companies involved in designing spacecraft that could go to the International Space Station and eventually to other space stations as well, if they're ever built. You have Boeing, they're building a vehicle, and this company, SpaceX, has built the Dragon crew vehicle. They call this one Demo 1 for Demonstration 1. And it launched from Florida, from Launch Complex 39A. That's the most famous launch complex because that's the one where the moon missions went on the Apollo Saturn flights, and then eventually the
Over half of the shuttle flights also flew out of that complex, Launch Complex 39A. Well, SpaceX was taking it over, and they rebuilt it, and they changed everything. And if you look at it now, if you look at the top of the vehicle when it's sitting on launch pad, there's this big 80-foot arm that swings out, and it's a walkway for astronauts to walk to the crew vehicle and eventually get in. That's all built. It's all functional. They tested it. They made sure that the arm works and everything. The only thing different with this mission and a mission that will take place in July, if this all goes correct, is that this is an unmanned mission. But this is a spacecraft where it's got four seats in it. You could have put astronauts in it and blasted them up to the International Space Station. What they did is they put four seats in. They put a mannequin in there, and it's got a spacesuit on, and they named the mannequin Ripley. Ripley from the movie Alien, with Sigourney Weaver was the actress. Well, now Ripley is sitting there with all kinds of monitors and inside the spacesuit, trying to figure out what kind of G loads and temperature, humidity, what kind of problems an astronaut might have. It's got all the sensors on board the mannequin. So it's sitting there in the chair. Let me drop it. And then on another chair right next to it, they had a little, looks like a stuffed animal, but it's the globe. It's Earth, and it's blue, and they do have two like hands and feet sticking out of it. But this stuffed animal sat on one of the chairs at launch, and it's a gadget. It's an idea that's been going on for some years. If you look at some of the Russian launches, they'll always have a little stuffed toy or something hanging from the ceiling. And what it is, they call it a zero gravity indicator. So it just either hangs, or in this case, it was sitting on the chair. And once it gets to zero G, the thing would start floating around. And they have nice, HD cameras inside the spacecraft. You could see what's going on. You could see Ripley's sitting there. You could see this little stuffed animal sitting on the chair. And they have a little tether on it. I noticed that when it was floating around. So it takes off. Very successful night launch. First stage separated from the second stage. First stage came back and found its way all the way back to the autonomous ship 400 miles out in the Atlantic Ocean, and landed vertically and very successfully right in the bullseye of the ship. He names the ship, "Of Course I Still Love You." That's the name of the landing vehicle. The second stage ignites and pushes the Dragon to orbit. Eventually, the Dragon separates from the second stage and spends the next, 15 hours catching up to the International Space Station, which it did successfully. If you watch this is like 5 o'clock in the morning, Dragon approached the International Space Station. And it goes through all the different kinds of procedures. Remember, this is unmanned, and it's all autonomous. It has this nose cover on the front of it that opens up on a hinge, and it allows the docking mechanism to push out from the front of it, and then it closes into the space station. The space station has a similar docking mechanism on it, and called the IDA, IDA, International Docking Adapter, this thing's going to mate to. The International Docking Adapter was set up there quite a few years ago, and it was installed by an EVA crew, and they installed it on the front end of the PMA, PMA-2. PMA is the pressure mating adapter. There's three of them located on board the International Space Station. And you can see, you can tell them what it is. It's, first of all, it's very dark looking, but it has this 22.5-degree offset to it. And, very unique. And it's an adapter that adapts to the berthing mechanism, which is usually very wide, about 55 inches wide. And it brings it down to a circular, you basically go from a square to a circle. And the circle is roughly a meter in diameter. Enough for small packages and a